This program was first broadcast on Canterbury's community access radio station Plains FM 96.9 and was made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
It's time for Bookends. Kia ora, welcome to Bookends with Ruth Todd and Maureen Rout.
Over the holiday season, Bookends brings you the best of 2018. Enjoy.
The Imaginary Lives of James Pornicky is a novel by Tina Macaretti. It's her second one. She has an impressive CV of editing work and publishing an earlier novel and a short story collection. She won the Pacific Regional Commonwealth Short Story Prize for her short story Black Milk. And she has a PhD in creative writing from Victoria University and currently teaches creative writing at Massey University. Tina, this is quite a remarkable book because it takes us from very early colonial New Zealand to England and introduces us to some pretty extraordinary characters. Tell us how this story eventuated.
Kia ora, Maureen. Yes, so I actually started with the story of the character in Britain, but realised I then needed to figure out how he got to Britain. So then I actually spent more time in New Zealand at the start of the novel than I was expecting. But the story really came from my own encounter with a couple of characters in history. One was Sarah Bartman, who is a Khoi Khoi woman of South Africa, who, if anyone's familiar with her, she was exhibited in Europe in the very early 19th century. And her story's really, really tragic, and quite awful things were done to her, but also quite complex in that when people tried to protect her from the men that were exploiting her, she also had a relationship with those men, so there's a bit of kind of non-clarity about what actually the relationship was and what actually how much choice she had in the situation she was in. I think to the modern eye, we can be pretty clear that there was a huge amount of coercion there. Mm. But the further tragedy of her life was that she was exhibited in life and in death. And so when I heard that story, I came across a book and read about her. I thought it was extraordinary that I hadn't heard the story before, and that the more that I found out about it, the more common I found, you know, the exhibition of living humans and non-living humans was at the time. And I kind of thought the book I read was an attempt at biography, but I thought, well, what would she have seen? What was her perspective? And of course, I felt that wasn't my story to tell. I wasn't from that place, and I don't think any amount of research would allow me to actually access her point of view. But I also knew that Māori people were travelling the world at that time, and so I thought, what if a Māori person went to London and saw that or was involved in a situation like that? And so that idea was in my head, and then I discovered that there was a young man taken by George French Angus to be part of his first exhibition of ethnographic materials and paintings. Obviously, he was an artist who came to New Zealand and South Australia to make images, so exhibiting humans wasn't his first objective, but in the end he took a young man to be part of that exhibition, and that certainly would have made it much more interesting for people and would have been, you know, a very exciting element of the exhibition. So it's not actually about George French Angus or Hemi Pōmare, who's the original, the real people. I had to move away from that completely because, you know, there's only a certain amount of information about them, and I didn't want to represent real people in my book. But I took that as a jumping off place to kind of imagine through the young Māori man's eyes this world of exhibition. And also the interesting thing about him was that, you know, that he was in between. So there were things that he got out of the relationship, like education and seeing the world. And so it's a much more complex relationship where, as an Indigenous person, I guess he finds himself asking, how much have I bought into the system, which is what I find myself asking as a contemporary Indigenous person.
Yes, because James Pornicky, you make him, you give him quite a bit of agency at the beginning in the sense of he wants to go as much as the artist, you never actually give him a name, the artist is wanting him to accompany him. So it is a complicit arrangement right at the beginning because he's a clever and thoughtful young man and he recognises that there could be something in this for him.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that's, we always have to be aware that the story's always a bit complex as I think just as humans, we tend to want to, you know, put people in categories those are the good ones, those are the bad ones, and they did, you know, they perpetuated this thing. And yes, the system itself, I find, is definitely this kind of, the word that's in my head right now is corrupt, but the way, you know, people are exploited. Yet, you know, there is we all are part of that system. So for me as a writer, I kind of went in with, you know, young man sees London, early Victorian London, and thinks, you know, they're calling him a savage, but who are the real savages here? Because it was a pretty crazy place.
Yes.
Which that was very fun to research.
Yes, but I was going to ask you about that. That must have been really, really intriguing. Mm.
Yeah. I've lost my thought a bit. But, at the same time, it's much more interesting, I think I wanted to say. It's much more interesting if he's not just judging that, if he's actually realising that it's, you know, he's got relationships with people there. He is interested in this new world. And what is the price of that interest? You know, we, as I guess historically, Māori were always interested in all these new things that were suddenly available, but have had to pay such an extraordinary price for that relationship. So, yeah, that was what was going on there.
You open with him writing a letter to the future, really, or communing with his future descendants, and hoping, mm-hmm. and you close as well in that same manner, hoping for a world that's completely different, that has sorted out all those inequities and evils. And that's quite poignant, really, isn't it, when we reflect on what have, you know, how far have we come from what was considered to be very, well, not primitive, but not very enlightened times.
Well, I think I think that was the big claim, wasn't it, of Western civilization, particularly at that time, that we are the highest point of civilization. Therefore, if you allow us, you know, we'll take over, and you'll have all the benefits of the civilization, and everything will be better. So, I think you know, he is trying to believe this thing that we've all been told, and yet, this kind of linear sense that this is a very kind of old anthropological point of view now, but I think it is kind of embedded in our culture that some cultures are primitive and some are advanced, and of course we know what the colour scale goes from the primitive to the advanced, don't we?
We sure do.
so he is kind of he's kind of trying to give it the benefit of the doubt and saying, okay, so you've promised us enlightenment, you've promised us, you know, the world. But that beginning and that ending were really, I wanted to have this kind of panoramic sense of the society, and that comes out of, you know, one of the most popular exhibits to go to at the time was the Panorama, where you would go and see, you know, you would see all these different representations of the world. It was kind of like the precursor to, I guess, a lot of films. But, yeah, this kind of sense of either moving or still panoramas of different cities and different parts of the world. So I guess I was trying to imitate that a bit in writing.
And in between those two pieces, he leads a very lively and at times raunchy, at times very very unpleasant. You have him his real lives, his imaginary lives, his real lives are hugely different at times. So, yes, it's such a colourful book in lots of ways, but it's amongst all of that is a great deal of food for thought.
Thank you.
So, The Imaginary Lives of James Pornicki by Tina Makariti is published by Vintage.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains FM 96.9. Gavin Bishop is one of New Zealand's award-winning book illustrators, author and artist, and with nearly 60 books published, his work ranges from original stories to retelling of Maori myths, European fairy stories, and nursery rhymes. Welcome to the program, Gavin.
Thank you very much.
Last year, you were awarded an honorary doctorate from the University of Canterbury. It just goes on and on. And in this wonderful new book, Aotearoa, The New Zealand Story, he showcases the best of our history through his evocative and exciting art, with all kinds of little texts telling us really amazing information, and I learned so much. But every time I look at it, I pick up something else that I didn't know about.
That's how it should be.
I didn't know that. I mean, I knew that there were heaps of native plants threatened by extinction, but I don't think I knew that there were 3,000.
Yes.
So those things are really important. And as you go through the book, you've covered so much. So let's talk about how it all started and how you did it.
Yes. Well, the initial idea came from Catherine O'Loughlin, who's the children's editor at Penguin Random House. And she rang up one day and just sort of more or less out of the blue, although it probably wasn't for her, was for me, said, would you be interested in doing a big format book on the history of New Zealand as a kind of, in a series of maps? You know, as you said, it's sort of like a kind of, you know, timeline book, but using maps to show the development of not only the geography of New Zealand, but the history and, you know, things like that. And I said, initially, I thought, wow, that's a fantastic idea, because I've always been really interested in maps. I've got a lot of books on maps at home, old ones and all sorts of things. And I said, I'd love to do that. And I started thinking about it, and a couple of days later, the penny sort of dropped, and I realised that this was a huge project, because she said, not only do we want a large format, but we want it to be twice the length of a normal picture book, which is 32 pages. So this is a 64-page book. It may not sound very long, but when you look at the book, each page is full of detailed drawings, which represents an enormous amount of research, and as well as a lot of text, and the text is slipped in amongst the little, you know, visual details.
It's full of details, and but the artwork behind the details, well, it's not really behind them, it's there, they're all together.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But what I loved was we sort of go from the past to the present to the future in this book too,
yeah.
And you have so many you know, stories, and the arts are there, of course, and the writers, the musicians, right up to this minute. You know, we're seeing contemporary people as well as the history of our country. And the pages, your amazing artwork, it just jumps off the page, really.
Thank you very much.
It's really exciting.
I'm glad it has that sort of impact.
Well, it does, because you just open it, and I know we're on radio, I'm sorry we're not on television, but there it is, employment, two double pages all the way, and gosh.
Well, that page there is one of the pages that I call a survey page. The book is arranged in a kind of chronological order. It starts about 150 million years ago with Gondwanaland.
Yes, of course.
And then every now and then it moves forward in a kind of linear way until we get to a page like the employment page, which is what I call a survey page. And it looks at employment from very early times in New Zealand up to the present time. So we've got, we've got a 1950s butcher. You'll notice that he's holding up a string of saveloys and he's got a cigarette in his mouth. Because I can remember very clearly when I was a child going to the butcher shop and the butcher would put his cigarette down in an ashtray before he served my mother. And that was quite common. And we'd thought nothing of it. But today, children would think that is very, very odd.
And we've got Short Arise.
We've got the Short Arise factory. And also down the bottom, we've got a reference to wetter workshops.
Yes, that's what I mean. We've got the, you know, what's happening now.
Yeah.
And I don't know, you know, I don't know all these places. I haven't been to see all of these places.
Well, I haven't either.
But how did you decide? It's almost... How did you decide what not to put in? I mean, it must have been...
Well, I had to stop when the page got full.
Yes.
So what I started off with was, I started off with the map of New Zealand for each double page spread.
Yes.
I put the map into some position on that spread. Now, sometimes it runs along the bottom, horizontally. Sometimes it's reduced so that it's really quite small. On the food page, I've actually reduced I've interpreted the map of New Zealand as a salt and pepper shaker. So,
yes. Well, I didn't see that in the second reading. And you really, I mean, it's like a treasure trove, really, because different things jump out.
It's the kind of book I would have liked as a child.
Oh,
it's the kind of book. We have these books that came from Britain that were sort of annuals, and I think they were called Big Dippers. And it meant you could open the book at any page and the story or the comic strip or whatever you were looking at would be complete on those two pages. And so you could open the book at any point and start reading at that point. And that's what this is sort of like.
And I like the glossary at the end too.
I think it's very important.
With the Māori words,
that's
so
really
good.
I think it's really important, yeah.
Because you've covered, you know, obviously the treaties there. But, you know, you've got a little sentence or two about the New Zealand company that was notorious for shady land purchases and sales and British government reluctant to make New Zealand a colony. So there's interesting facts in here
that
can lead, especially if a child's with an adult, to more discussion.
That's right. And I think I'm particularly pleased with the land war page, this one here.
Yes, yes.
Because it actually does look at some of the issues that really I don't think have been addressed to this day, you know, especially in our education system. We don't teach our children about this part of our past. And the fact that this illegal confiscation of land by the New Zealand government, you know, as a kind of punishment for protecting their land, the Māori were treated, you know, despicably.
Yes,
it's heartbreaking to read that material.
It's very important. It's very important. It's far more important to me
than reading about the First World War all the time.
Yes,
and I know.
These are our wars that we need to know about, and our kids need to know about.
I think so too. Mm.
And you've just got, you know, heads of people, just their head. The profile, and then you've got...
And the colour on this page is symbolic too, where it starts off and it's kind of blue over here, because the previous page is blue as well.
Yes.
And then this kind of sort of the rot sets in at the bottom of this page in this kind of pusy, purpley colour. And that continues onto the next page as well with the depression, the Long Depression. Again, a lot of people don't know about this period of depression.
No, they only know about the 1930s.
That's right. Mm. Yes, right. But this was a major one that took place after the land wars, after the finish of the land wars.
And that was the time of Kate Shepherd, of course, too. And
right.
I do never think of her being as part of the Depression, you know.
Yeah. But maybe
maybe
one of the reasons that she came forward at that time.
Yes, I don't know either, but that's never mentioned in any...
But also, see, transport around New Zealand during that time was almost impossible unless you went by boat because the roads were impassable in a lot of places. And that's why it's followed the page. You'll notice that the pusey, purpley colour starts to fade out as things improve with transport on that page.
I didn't really notice that.
You'll get that the next time.
Next time, yes. But that's so good to have that explained because I hadn't connected that with the mood of the time.
I like making books that have a lot of layers, even if they might seem...
Oh, well, that's your strength.
I like them. I like it to be simple, but multi-layered.
And I'm sure not very many people know that Evelyn Brooke was matron on the hospital ship Mahino that made 5 visits to Anzac Cove at Gallipoli in 1915.
Isn't that amazing?
5 visits.
Isn't that amazing?
I never knew that. No, I knew that, you know, they got...
Those ships, those hospital ships, sailed in there to pick up the wounded... And take them away to safety. It's just incredible.
And they didn't get to find safety, did they?
No.
So it's just a wonderful, wonderful book, Gavin. All your books are wonderful, but this kind of is at the peak, isn't it, of something that you...
I think it's a book that I couldn't have done 20 or 30 years ago because it is a kind of book that has gained a lot from my having been around for a long time.
Mm.
And...
60 books. I had no idea you'd written 60 books and illustrated 60 books, and apart from all the other things you do.
Right, yes.
Ah, it's just
busy.
So, so beautiful.
Thank you.
And it belongs in every home and every school, doesn't it? I mean, I think it's so important to have these books out there. If people don't have them in their homes, they need to be in the schools. And I hope, and libraries, of course.
Yeah.
But I hope schools are ordering them and buying this book because it is the most special book on the New Zealand story that I've
Thank
ever come
very,
across.
Thank it's you very much.
Just fantastic. You're amazing. So look for Aotearoa, the New Zealand story by Gavin Bishop, and it's published by Penguin Random House.
Thank you very much.
And join us, Maureen Rout and Ruth Todd, next Tuesday on Bookends on Plains FM 96.9.